The Mexican stared at him. There was no gun in the hands of Weldon, and yet Cabrero hesitated to reach for one of his own weapons. There was a button just behind his chair. He could press it by leaning back. There was another button under his foot. He could press that also. But both buttons simply brought armed men to his door. That was hardly enough. However, it was better to do what he could. He pressed the button on the floor. He leaned back against the wall. Like a whisper, a bell rang in the distance. He looked earnestly at Weldon. That gentleman's face did not alter. "And now, the safe?"
"Certainly,"
he turned, took a key from his pocket, twisted a knob in the face of the big safe, turned the key, and the door sagged open with the softest of hissing sounds. "5,000," Weldon said gently, as one assisting the memory of a friend, without breaking too roughly upon the current of his thoughts.
5,000, of course," Cabrero said pleasantly.
He counted out the money in crisp, fresh $100 bills, American currency. He put the stack on the table and patted it with his hand.
"Will you count now, my friend?"
"Thank you," Weldon said. "I counted them at the same time that you put them together. Now you may close the door of the safe again." The color of Cabrero grew more clear and bright. He eagerly obeyed. "And now, Señor Cabrero, a little note. It will run, 'I, Miguel Cabrero, having taken from Lorimer Everett Weldon $5,000 by means of illegal gambling devices, and in particular by means of a break on a roulette wheel, have returned the money to him on this day.' That will be all, Señor, for the moment." Cabrero looked down at the desk and folded his hands on top of it. Outside in the hall there was the faintest of sounds, a ghost of a noise, but he knew what it meant.
"Well," he murmured.
He took out a paper and a fountain pen with a thick, flexible stub point. With this he began to write. It was amazing to see the size of the letters that the little man wrote, and the quantity of ink that went into every stroke. Though it flowed freely, he freshened the flow by shaking ink vigorously onto the floor, which already was thickly splattered. Then he took a sheet of fresh, white blotting paper and passed it over the writing. He looked at the face of the blotter with curiosity. Every letter was well represented, and the writing on the paper had turned a pale blue.
"And that is all?"
"All of this step. Next, we go to look at your stable."
"Ah, well, you want a horse?"
"I think I should have one, don't you?"
"As you please."
Weldon stepped backward and opened the door halfway. He did not look out, but continued to gaze at the face of the Mexican, who saw in the hallway half a dozen crowded figures, naked guns in their hands. They had had to do work like this before, and a wave of cruel joy rushed over Miguel Cabrero and almost choked him. Weldon was saying, "Tell your faithful friends to leave the hall. You are with an honest companion." Mechanically, the words fell from the lips of Cabrero. There was a soft tapping of heels. The hall was empty. A door clicked in the distance. "So we can go on cheerfully to the stable," Weldon continued calmly. "You, my dear Cabrero, walking always in front, and I behind, to guard your back." Cabrero could not keep his upper lip from curling back across his white, glistening teeth. He was very angry indeed, but he stood up and walked from the room, not in too much haste. He went down the hall. Fear was being born in him, and he was only anxious to see the last of this big demon, this American fiend. They went from the corridor across an open yard. They entered a low shed. A dozen horses stood there. Weldon looked them over, noting their quarters only. "Good," he said. "And now, your own horses?" The lip of Cabrero curled back again, but again he made no sound. He began to tremble with fury greater than his fear, but he went on from the horse shed through a door at the end of it. Here there were six big box stalls, Five of them were tenanted. There was an electric light burning over each one, and, sauntering past them behind Cabrera, Weldon gave a long glance through each doorway. Then he returned to a stall where was a tall chestnut, a horse of a weak, faded color. "This one will do for me," Weldon said.
"Dios,"
said the gambler through his teeth. "And what did you pay for this excellent horse, my friend?"
"There stands $1,500 in gold."
"Tut, that is a price and a half. But the honest price?"
"Do you think he pays me to lie to you? You—"
Cabrero clipped down his fat lips and kept the last word from exploding. But his whole face and throat shuddered with his fury. Weldon passed a hand into his pocket and fingered the recently received bills. Then he took out a sheaf of them and gave them to his companion. "For that price, you throw in saddle and bridle, Cabrero?" Cabrero turned purple as he looked at the money.
"An honest man,"
he said, breathing very hard.
"In spots,"
the genial Weldon smiled. "Will you saddle him?" The gambler obeyed. "Which is the best way out, Cabrero? You will be interested because you are going with me for a step or two." Cabrero paused. Then it seemed better to take the chance.
"That door leads to an empty alley.
You go down it and turn to the left. In 5 minutes you are out of town." "Lead the way, then." They left the shed. Outside, to be sure, there was a little alley, and Weldon sprang into the saddle. Cabrero whirled. He was looking into the muzzle of a .45-caliber Colt. Then he actually laughed aloud.
"You, senor, are a talented man."
"One cannot live without learning a little," said the American. Cabrero walked down to the head of the alley. There stretched a dimly winding way to the left, lost among the houses. "This is the way, Cabrero?"
"Yes, straight down this alley."
"I'll watch you go back, senor." Cabrero bowed, turned, and walked without hurrying down the alley. When he had disappeared into the shed, Weldon set the horse into the winding way, and then he heard from the distance behind him a thin whistle, rapidly repeated. "He gives the signal," Weldon thought, smiling and putting the chestnut into a strong gallop. Chapter 7. With the first stride, he knew that all was not well. The big horse lunged out his head like the thrust of a piston. Weldon drew hard on the reins. The chestnut merely shook his head and bored harder than before. They began to fly down the alley. A pile of junk rose around a sharp bend. There was the dangerous glint of old tin cans, but the chestnut flew over it.
"Good boy," murmured Weldon.
Suddenly the chestnut braced himself. He slid 20 feet through thin surface sand and brought up inches away from a tall stone walk. It blocked the whole end of the alley, and Weldon could understand why it was that the gambler invited him to take this way. He swung the chestnut around, but there might be time to get back across the throat of the passage leading out from the horse shed of Cabrero. But no, that chance was too small. The wall was at least 9 feet high. He cast his hand on it and lightened himself in the saddle, raising himself up. It was a broad wall, but a top stone stirred under his hand. A good broad wall, at least a foot thick, and made of heavy stones, and yet that topmost one had stirred under his hand. He laid hold of it. It gritted against its holding mortar and came away, falling with a deep thud on the sand beneath. He gripped the next stone below. It sagged. He pulled again with a force that made the gelding stagger. But the stone came free. Powdered mortar showered down, and then the masonry on either side of the dislodged bit slipped loose. Whoever built that wall had scorned the use of honest cement. Weldon laid hold upon it with mighty hands, and it crumbled beneath him. A thick heap of stones fell. The chestnut danced uneasily as his shins were barked by the impacts. But then all progress ended. The wall broadened to more than 2 feet, and its rigid force belittled the might of Weldon. He understood then. There had been this powerful wall, and the facing on top was merely a sort of palisade to heighten the effect. There was well over 5 feet of that massive obstacle. Could the chestnut jump it? Weldon whirled him away to a sufficient distance. There he sat motionlessly in the saddle. Behind him, distinctly, he heard a stifled grunt and curse, as of a man who stumbles as he runs. Then he pointed the chestnut, took him firmly in hand, and sent him forward. He knew by the first move that the fellow was a jumper. He went with short, springing bounds, like a rabbit spy-hopping when the hounds are an unknown distance behind. So the chestnut went at the fence. But after all, there is a gap between will and performance, and yonder was more than a 5-foot wall, with the take-off reasonably slippery sand, littered, moreover, by big, rough-edged stones. As for the landing place on the farther side, it might be in a sheer ditch for all he knew. But there was a generous heart in that washed-out chestnut. In that convincing moment, Weldon knew why Cabrero had groaned when this mount was chosen. Weldon touched the tender flanks with the spurs and swayed his weight forward. Gallantly rose the chestnut, ears flattened, powerful quarters thrusting mightily. They soared high, and yet not high enough. Hanging in mid-leap, Weldon saw the splotched blackness of a garden beneath him, a soft landing, if ever they can make it. But how would this fellow get his hind legs over? Then he felt the hitch of the loin muscles. He could see as though he was standing at one side, the heels of the chestnut neatly tucked up under his belly, and they slid over with only a faint scraping of hoofs, shot down, and landed almost silently in garden loam. Behind him, from the lane, voices suddenly boiled over with bewilderment and rage. Footfalls came, running. For that instant, he was safe, but he was fenced around by that same lofty wall on 3 sides, and on the other was the awkward mass of the house. He turned in the saddle to watch the gap through which he had jumped the chestnut, and the smile of Weldon would not have been good to see by daylight. But turning, something glinted in the side wall of the garden close, the handle of a door, perhaps. He pushed the chestnut to it and leaned. A door indeed. But when he tried the handle, it was locked fast. To make matters, if possible, worse, a shutter crashed open, and a man's voice called loudly, "Who is that?" A good ringing voice it was, as of a man of action, and glancing up over his shoulder, there was enough starlight for Weldon to see the gleam of a long barrel. Then an old maxim thrust into his mind. He who rides must be ready for a fall. He answered that maxim with his usual smile. San Trinidad is not big enough to trip me. Then he put the mouth of a revolver against the lock in the gate and fired. The gate was easily pushed wide. He dipped low in the saddle, and the chestnut carried him through, not into lane or street, but into open country, with the dim silver of the Rio Negro glimmering in the near distance. He had come through the edge of the town as through the wall of a fortress. As he observed these things with his first glance, a gun barked with a short, hoarse cough, and a small shot rattled against the wall. But he was safe enough. Yonder across the Rio Negro, he could see the blinking of a light or two, and the sharp upward thrust of a few roofs. That was the little town of Juniper on the American side, and he must make that place for safety. He gave the chestnut his head again. But now the big fellow did not attempt to take charge as he had done in the alley. That barking of shins, that leap into darkness, that passage through the dark garden had, apparently, convinced him that this man was good enough to be his master. He went smoothly, well in hand, and cantered down to the water's edge. There was not a sight or a sound behind. It was as though Miguel Cabrero wisely had made up his mind that bad luck must be accepted philosophically, and the hands washed with at least an air of indifference. So Weldon sat quietly by the river for a moment, tasting life and this new moment with a placidly keen enjoyment. The river was as smooth as glass, except for a telltale bubbling sound in the center. But one could not imagine that, not many moments before, this same water had been roaring through the black canyon, looking possessed of devils. All was black from the side of San Trinidad, except at the bridgehead, where the customs people kept lights flaring as though to warn smugglers that there was no passing at that point. From the American shore, however, a scattering of rays made pale yellow marks on the black of the water. And in the standing pools and backwater along the edges, the stars revealed themselves. Weldon could have sat there in the saddle half the night. But after all, Cabrero was not as harmless as all that. He went down to the widest place, which must necessarily be the shallowest. The chestnut walked carefully, his head pushed down, sniffing at the water, as though he were asking after the secrets of its hidden depths. He plumped suddenly into a pool that soaked Weldon to the breast, swam a few struggling yards, and found bottom again. Dripping, cold, with the water crashing underfoot, they got up the farther shore, and Weldon rode calmly into the town. He found the hotel, gave the muddy, wet horse to the groom at the rear of the building, and stood by to watch the feeding of the good horse. In 1 hour he had become a friend, an intimate. He sniffed at Weldon affectionately, and Weldon stroked the lean, hard neck. He said to the stable boy, "You shoot squirrels, son?"
"Sometimes. Why?"
"Where's your shotgun?"
"Right beside the door."
"Suppose you keep that gun with you tonight, and you might sit in the manger, here." The boy was silent, his face upturned. Then Weldon explained frankly enough, "You know Miguel Cabrero?"
"Aw, sure."
"You know any good of him?"
"No, I don't."
"I paid him $1,500 for that horse, but I think he'd like to get him back." He put $10 into the hand of the youngster, and that hand closed on the money so strongly that it crunched like a bone under the grip.
$1?
He asked hopefully.
$10,
son," said Weldon.
"Well," said the boy through his teeth, "there ain't enough greases in the world to grab that hoss. You go on in and go to sleep."
Weldon took that advice. There was no charm about this hotel. There was no dignity about the proprietor. He was in his shirt sleeves, and clean sleeves they were not. He smoked the butt of a foul black cigar as he showed Weldon to a room.
"Nothing better?" Weldon asked. "It's good enough for me. Ain't it good enough for you?"
So Weldon took it with a little sigh. His fingers itched and his muscles quivered, but he let the proprietor depart in peace and settle down for the night. He had not wakened until evening of that day. Now it was not very late, but he was ready to sleep again. Sleep was the one servant always at his command. He locked the door and wedged a roll of matting beneath it. He put the chair sidewise beneath the window, and then he lay down, resolutely put out of his mind the smell of stale cookery that pervaded the room, and went to sleep. Dreamless and pure as the sleep of a little child was this slumber of Weldon. Once a hand tried his door. He wakened and leveled a revolver, but the noise stopped, and Weldon slept again, and only wakened when the sun was high, casting a wave of brilliance and oven heat into the room. At the door, a hand was beating. When he opened it, he found Cunningham on the outside. Chapter 8 They breakfasted together in the dingy dining room, and it was then that Weldon noticed a lump on the side of Cunningham's head.
"What's that?" he asked.
"I followed you a little too quickly," said Cunningham. "One of the Mexicans discouraged me in this way." He changed the subject carelessly. "It was a grand little fight, but is it true that you called on Cabrero?"
"Yes, Cabrero showed me the way out."
Cunningham began to crumble the stiff, stale bread with his strong fingers.
"You say you really dropped in on Cabrero?"
"He's a polite fellow," Weldon said. "Gave me back what his crooked machine had taken from me." Cunningham leaned back in his chair and sighed with pleasure. "How I should have liked to see that. And then you took one of his horses?"
"Not at all. I bought one."
"What?"
"For $1,500. That's a fair price, isn't it?"
Cunningham shook with laughter and then shook again. He wiped his eyes and steadied himself. "I thought before that we would have to have you. Now I know it. You can write your own ticket, Weldon."
"Are you the head of this work?" asked Weldon.
"I? By no means. I'm a sort of general of brigade in contact with the enemy."
"May I ask some questions?"
"Not until you're in the organization."
"I'll try one.
Who's the lovely child with the long gray car?"
"She," Cunningham said, "is a darling."
"Yours?"
"Nobody's," Cunningham said, not affronted by this calm bluntness. "She's all by herself. You like her?"
"Of course."
"There's no one like her," said Cunningham.
"Is she part of the show?"
Cunningham tapped the table thoughtfully.
"I can't tell you that," he decided.
"It might make a big difference," said Weldon.
Cunningham looked sharply at him.
"That's your weakness, is it?" he said.
"That's one of them."
"No matter what comes of this, let me tell you that Francesca is a fiend. Soberly, I tell you that."
"Treacherous?"
"Dangerous," Cunningham said. "There's no more heart in that beautiful body of hers than there is in that wooden post."
"Nonsense," Weldon smiled. "Everybody has a weakness.
Hers is for danger."
"I have a special taste for hot things."
Cunningham shook his head gravely.
"Mind you, you're still on the outside. I'm talking out of school now. But after your little game of last night, I want to give you a fair chance from the start. LaGuardia is a beauty, but look at her like a picture on the wall. Admire her all you please, but leave your heart out of it. You know, Weldon, there are two kinds, those that go to perdition and those that send others there. The first kind may be foolish, but they're apt to be pathetic, too. The second kind is simply no good. You know Balzac?"
"I've tried him."
"There's one of the second kind in The Magic Skin."
Weldon observed the distant face of Bull Mountain, solid and formidable.
"Lovely voice," he observed. "Let's drop it."
"Shall I talk terms?"
Weldon hesitated. So far, he was inclined to like Cunningham in many ways, but he had not yet made up his mind, for that mind worked slowly, seeing many facets of an idea before it was fixed.
"I want some time," he said. "I may want even another look or two at San Trinidad."
"Riding Cabrero's horse?" asked Cunningham.
"Why not?" Weldon said.
Cunningham smiled, but his brow remained dark. "You might get on with the LaGuardia after all. Whatever else she is a daredevil."
"Ah, but I'm not," Weldon protested.
"Only, life can't be all beef and potatoes. Have to have a little pepper."
"You want to think things over," Cunningham said. "Good morning, doctor," he called to a bowed figure coming slowly up the path.
"I'll tell you this to begin with." He turned to Weldon again. "We'll offer $1,000 a month. That's not final. Perhaps we could start you even higher. But $1,000 per at least. I have authority to offer that. Afterward, why, I know what you can do. Very soon you'd be cutting the big melons with us."
"It's a very pleasant suggestion," said Weldon. Then he waved the whole idea away. "Let me have the thought for a while. The sun's hot enough here to incubate it."
Cunningham nodded. When he had finished breakfast a little later, he left, with word that he would return in the evening, if possible. Then Weldon went out on the veranda to smoke and dream. The stable boy came lounging around the corner and waited to be noticed.
"Sleep well?" asked Weldon.
The boy grinned.
"They come all right," he said. "Two. I unhooded the lantern when they got into the stall.
You sure must have heard 'em screeching as they made their getaway. They seen the shotgun and thought it was a funeral."
Weldon gave him another $10. "That's to polish up your eyes." He smiled, and the boy disappeared. There was no blacker scene in the world than the village street on which Weldon brooded. Across the river, San Trinidad possessed a pungent charm. Mystery clung to the shadowy patios and the deep casements. But there was a street of frame shacks, such as the American throws up when he first lays his hand on a new land. Frame, or corrugated iron, or canvas, or anything cheap. Then he wrestles with the problems of the new country, and solves those problems. Afterward, cities of brick and stone arise swiftly. So Weldon understood this frontier, this staggering wreck of a village. The ground had been broken. It was not certain whether there ever would be a yield from the soil, but at least the investment had been small. 10 attempts, let one of them succeed, and the return is richly worthwhile. So all across the continent the way was spotted with failures, little ruined villages that were soon rained back into the ground. But the 10th village always turned into a smoking city. He thought of these things, dimly proud of his race, more than dimly aware that he was not a part of it. He was no portion of the current that flows, but a mere touch of unimportant foam upon the surface. He did not grow melancholy in this brooding. His thoughts were no more to him than pictures hung in a gallery. But he put himself on the wall along with other things, and calmly regarded the ugly features. A halting step came down the veranda and paused beside him.
"You're Mr. Weldon? I'm Dr. Henry Watts. May I sit down here?"
It was the bowed man who had come up the path. He took the next chair, sitting down cautiously, lowering himself, as though he feared the strength of his legs might give way. Then he mumbled for a moment and sighed. It seemed a great accomplishment that he had done so much as this. He had in his hands a powerful knotted stick on which he leaned, and seemed to regard the toes of his clumsy boots, not riding boots. In every respect, Dr. Henry Watts was a pedestrian figure. He was a man who looked not more than 50, but with the weakness of one at least 10 years older. He had a long face, shrouded in part by a ragged gray beard that grew up into scanty sideburns. His neck was thin, and two cords at the back of it thrusting out against his loose collar. It was a stiff white collar, and the cuffs that showed beneath the bottom of his sleeves were clean and white also. Very white they looked against the big, loose, blue veins that covered the backs of his hands. Weldon, apparently dreaming over the sun-flooded street, was noting these details. He decided at once that Henry Watts was a gentleman and a man of education. The weakly, sagging head seemed to be burdened with a weight of thought.
"Cunningham wants you, I see," said the doctor.
Weldon made no answer. He merely turned his pleasant, unintellectual smile upon the other.
"And, of course, he has good reason," went on Dr. Henry Watts. "After last night..."
Even Weldon's smile was not quite proof against this remark, and Henry Watts explained rather hastily in his soft, deep voice,
"Of course, everyone has heard about it. On the other side of the river they chatter, you know. They talk a great deal. So we hear the reports on this side, too. There are wires that connect the two towns. Wires overground, wires underground."
He lifted his weak head sidewise and smiled at Weldon, not with sharp, smart suggestion, but gently, like an old man amused at life and its odd ways.
"And when I heard what you had done," he said, "it occurred to me that perhaps you would let me talk to you seriously."
"Of course you may," Weldon said, always gentle.
I talked it over with my client, said Dr. Watts. She agreed with me that perhaps you were the man. We want you also, Mr. Welton, though we can't offer you such high pay as Mr. Cunningham can offer. But we can offer you danger, which is even greater, and the chance to do a beautiful and good deed, sir.
Chapter 9. If a wayside beggar, raising himself, had been transformed into a shining emperor, it would not have been more wonderful to Weldon than to hear this quiet and sad-voiced old man so speak to him. He replied with his usual gentleness, "You and a friend are in great trouble, Dr. Watts?"
"My friend is in great trouble, and I am worried because of her."
He looked wistfully at Weldon, as though he wanted most eagerly to find words for his thought, but found those words difficult and slow in coming to his tongue. But seeing that the younger man waited with perfect courtesy and patience, at last he said,
"It is a little hard to talk so openly with a stranger. But suppose that I put the case to you nakedly in outline. Then, if it interests you at all, we could go to the place, and there you could make up your mind more definitely."
Weldon hesitated. He would have been glad enough to come to the help of this good man and his friend, whoever she might be, but there was another matter that covered his mind, as a great cloud will sometimes cover the sky. There was Cunningham, shrewd, strong, and brave. There was the wild work that lay at Cunningham's hand, ready to offer to him. There was the magnificent salary that went with that work, and upon how many things Weldon could spend money with pleasure. And above all, there was the fascinating figure of Francesca LaGuardia, dangerous, beautiful, and strange. Though Cunningham would not admit that she was a part and portion of this illegal corporation of smugglers, he was reasonably sure that she was a member. Otherwise, Cunningham would not have been at such pains to warn him against her in the beginning, before Weldon himself was included. However, he could not help listening to the doctor to the end. There was such eagerness and hope in the voice of Henry Watts that Weldon already felt like a cruel elder refusing money to a starving child. So instead of speaking his mind, he said simply, "There's no reason why I shouldn't hear you. I'd be happy to hear you, Dr. Watts."
"Thank you," said the old man. "Then, briefly, but as clearly as I can, as clearly as I can."
He locked his big, old, feeble hands together, and nodded his head as the facts were summoned into his mind.
"I have a client, a patient, I should say. She lives yonder in the woods on the side of Los Altos. Do you see? If you look between those two chimneys, and then just a little above them, there you see a raw yellow gap on the side of the mountain. That is the canyon. Now, still lower and to the right, the woods go up like shadows piled on one another. That is the place. And shadows are piled there. Shadows are piled there. Danger, heaven knows, and death, perhaps, for the purest and the dearest of women, Mr. Weldon."
Now Weldon was reasonably steadfast in his mind and true to his first resolutions, but as the old doctor spoke, extending his uncertain hand, his dim eyes squinting at more than the physical facts of those mountains, and looking into a life of sorrow yonder among the pines, Weldon felt himself torn adrift from Cunningham and that first rich temptation. Even the splendid form of the LaGuardia, as Cunningham was apt to call her, grew a little distant, and the sweet, low voice spoke far away in his mind. He remained silent, but he sat a little forward in his chair and rested his elbows on his knees.
"She is Helen O'Malley," said the doctor. "She lives there in the house that her father built. He was General O'Malley. You may have heard of that name?
No, I haven't heard of it, said Weldon.
When I first came west, the doctor said, everyone knew about him. It seems wonderful to me that people forget so soon. He was one of the makers of the country. He was one of the strong-handed men who come first, and afterward the creepers like myself steal in. And when the strong men find a glorious empire, we find, perhaps, no more than peace and pure air that cures disease.
He shook his head, wondering mildly at these things. Weldon felt that another door had been opened for his comprehension of the good doctor. This was a confirmed invalid, and the weight of sickness was that which he still carried on his bowed shoulders. The doctor went on, gathering his thoughts about him.
I don't want to trouble you about the general. He was a good and a great man. Should I say good?
He paused to decide that question more deliberately.
Strong, at least,
he qualified his words,
and good in the general effect. But like most strong men, he did not always keep his power confined to the best channels. He overflowed. He became at times a fierce flood that endangered those around him. He had many enemies. Some envied him. All feared him. Except his daughter.
At this word he came to another pause, for words seemed to bring into the mind of the old man such bright and powerful images that he had to halt in order to let them fade a little before he could put them into connected speech. Then he said,
General O'Malley fought Indians, rode a pony express, drove stages, did many things. He had no fear of anything, or man, or mystery. When the flush of his youth was ended, then he turned his mind to other affairs than mere danger and fighting. Though, to the end, danger was his bright goddess, as she was to Harry Hotspur. Nevertheless, he found time to do other things. He bought cattle. They increased in numbers. He interested himself in mining. Wherever he put down his hand, there was gold when he removed it. He became wealthy, though not overpoweringly rich as in these days of billionaires wealth is counted, but truly comfortable and more than comfortable. Now, as the years went by, he determined to marry. He was nearly 50 then. He found a girl who loved his great, brave past, and who loved him because of it. As Desdemona loved Othello, Mr. Weldon, quite that way.
This O'Malley was a half-breed, then? Weldon asked a little sharply.
The purest, unmixed Irish, responded the doctor. Oh, no, have no fear of that. He married.
The unhappy wife died when her little girl was born.
That beautiful Helen, who lives there still in the old house. And as she grew up, the old general grew old. When she was 10, he was 60. When she was 20, he was 70. Age brought a little stiffness upon his mind. He began to draw in from his greater activities. Little by little he sold off his properties, his cattle, his mines. You are bored, Mr. Weldon?
Aye, oh, not a whit. Never more interested in my life, I think.
That makes me very happy. I cannot talk like Helen, but I can do my best. Now then, when he had finished selling off his property, he died. His will simply left everything to his daughter. But now comes the strange touch. There was hardly anything to leave.
He raised a long, gnarled forefinger as he spoke. His eyes widened with wonder and alarm beneath the bushy gray brows.
There was hardly a thing, he repeated.
"He'd been playing the stock market on the side?" asked Weldon.
"Ah, perhaps, perhaps."
"Everything swept clean away?"
"Ah, not everything. I should not say that.
There is a small competence on which Helen O'Malley lives, up there in the old house. Poor child. The grief caused by the death of her father brought on the greatest trouble of all, no doubt. Or perhaps the disease was there before. Strange, was it not, in this country of pure air, life-giving air? Consumption, Mr. Weldon."
"Ah, that's bad," said Weldon. "Poor girl." The old man looked tenderly upon him.
"You have a gentle heart, sir," he said.
Then he went on.
"But as she lay ill, weak, but still hopeful of life, she began to remember certain things about the death of her father, the disappearance so strangely of his money. She began to fear that perhaps, after all, it had not been so natural."
He paused. The dreadful thought had stopped his voice.
"And then, Mr. Weldon,"
he went on, breathless and hurrying in a whisper,
"then, sir, lately she had felt certain that a man or men are trying to come to her in her house for only one purpose. I beg your pardon. It is hard for me to go on."
He sank back in his chair. His hands were visibly quivering, though he had locked them together again. "Do you mean to do her harm?"
"I fear so. That is in her mind."
"Old enemies of her father?"
"Ah, that, perhaps."
"Do you mean, Dr. Watts, that this girl lives yonder in fear of murder?"
"Yes, yes, yes, I mean that."
Weldon set his teeth and his blue eyes blazed. "What people live in the house with her?" he asked.
"An old negress. There is also a man of all work. He is old, too, and I live not very far away in the hills."
"An old man, a negress," Weldon muttered.
"And in this constant dreadful fear, when she heard that you had done those extraordinary things in San Trinidad, because Señor Cabrera is a known man," the doctor said confidentially, "she hoped against hope, that perhaps she would be able to secure protection from you. Do you understand? She could not afford to give all that you could command from others, no doubt. But she would offer you $100 a month, and the life," the doctor hastened to add eagerly, "would be a very simple one. There would be no onerous duties, no physical labor."
He paused. Eagerly, almost pitifully, he waited. And Weldon saw with dreadful brightness the picture of this old man, the wasted girl lying in her bed, the frightened, doddering negress, and the unnamed peril that overhung that house. Far off now sounded the voice of Francesca LaGuardia, like the chime of sheep bells drowned in the wind.
"Suppose we go up to see the house and talk the whole thing over," Weldon suggested.
Chapter 10 Weldon rode the tall chestnut up the hill. He was an ugly beast with a great long head that looked not the least part of the good blood that was in him. However, he had been tried and proved, and he went up the hill with a gait as charming as his looks were ugly. As for Dr. Watts, he had a little inexpensive automobile that went with great roaring, yet managed to climb over the rough trail with a goat-like agility. It seemed to Weldon that it went better uphill than on the level. They had a full hour and a half of steady work before them to the lower edge of the trees, and then there was another stretch of even more difficult going, for the roadbed was quite ruined, but at last they came on the site of the house itself. One expects inanimate things to share the emotions of those near them. But if this was the house of misery, it had not the slightest look of such a condition. It was a building in the Spanish style, two stories high and done in heavy stone. The walls had a strange look, but the rocks had apparently been picked up just as they were found littering the side of the mountain and worked haphazard into the masonry, so that great points and jags often thrust out. Yet even from a distance, one could tell that the work was solidly done. Over these heavy walls, strong enough to make a fortress, climbing vines wandered everywhere, springing from one roughness to another. One of the vines was in flower. It spilled white bloom down an entire side of the building. It was not a big house. It was not a beautiful house. Its deep, rather narrow casements gave it a somewhat secluded, reflective appearance, and yet there was a vast air of contentment about it. Weldon ventured to guess that the general was the sort of man who never had any doubts as to the value of what he was doing. That secure self-complacency showed in every nook of this structure, as Weldon saw it. Its ugly outline, for instance. The downhill wall was thrice the height of the upper. But he could see at least one good reason for placing the building at that spot. It was on a rounding of the mountain shoulder. West of north, one looked up the rough pass between Los Altos and Mount Cumberland. To the south, the Rio Negro appeared, white with anger out of the muzzle of the Negro Canyon. And farther on, one saw the river smooth itself to approach dingy juniper and white San Trinidad on the farther bank. It was a sweeping view. It lifted one's heart to swing the eye across three parts of a circle in this fashion. "He was a man with a will," observed Weldon. He had dismounted from his horse, and the doctor had brought his old car to a halt and climbed out. He did not need to be told what was in Weldon's mind.
"The general was a man who must have his way," he answered. "Shall we go in?"
"Let's take our time," Weldon responded. "We might as well look around." There were not many outbuildings. The barn and stable was a smaller unit than one would have expected to find on the place of a rich man. There were a few sheds. Everything was made more substantially of the same rock work out of which the house itself had been constructed. Between the stable and the rear of the house, a sort of Spanish courtyard appeared. The house made one wall. There were rude stone parapets to make the other three quarters of the enclosure. The patio within was flagged with huge stones, and in the center of it appeared the well, with a prodigious black mouth.
"Cost a small fortune to dig that well there," said the doctor, "but the general had started on that spot to find water, and he insisted on blasting his way down through the rock. He had to go deep, as you can see, before he came to the water."
In fact, when Weldon leaned over the hole, he could not see water at all at first. He had to shade his eyes and peer closely before he could see the gleam far beneath. A winding flight of stairs, streaked with green moss, went down the side of the well, circling in swift spirals that seemed to increase the apparent sense of depth. This should have been a bleak enough patio, but on the contrary, in spite of its naked rock, it gave a most cheerful effect. There were some scant sprays of climbing vines growing here and there on the enclosing walls. The house wall itself was, like all the rest of that building, drenched in flowering greenery. And up the slope appeared first the sharply peaked roof of the barn, and then the tall and fragrant pines that mounted higher and higher in ranks that closed very shortly and became a solid mass of dark green.
"One could be pretty cheerful here," Weldon observed.
"Ah, and the general was the happiest of men. He used to have his coffee here in the morning. He used to sit here on hot afternoons. He preferred this blind view to the sweeping one from the front, I think. That view was like himself, huge and vital. And he liked contrasts. His wife was a delicate, clinging girl, for instance. Strong men are often like that."
They entered the house just as a shrill voice cried from the interior,
"You no-count rascal! You thief! I'm going to just blast you one of these here days if I catch you in my house again, General!"
A black cat shot down the hall and darted between the legs of Weldon.
"That's the General in this case," the doctor smiled. "General Sherman, Aunt Maggie calls him, because he's a great plunderer of kitchen supplies."
"Is Maggie old enough to remember the Sherman days?"
"Not at all, but she was raised on the stories of them. She's a good soul."
Aunt Maggie was seen waddling down the hall, a stout poker in her hand. When she saw them, she cleared the thunder from her brows and drew to one side with a pleasant smile.
"I've brought a friend to look the house over. He's interested in General O'Malley."
It seemed odd to Weldon that his presence should need to be explained in such detail to a negress cook. As he went on, he made a point of stumbling over a small step, and that gave him a chance to glance back under his arm toward Aunt Maggie. She had not moved from the place where she permitted them to pass her, and looking after them, he thought that there was an expression of almost fierce suspicion on her face. However, cooks are apt to be odd people, and negress cooks are no exception to that rule. He went up the stairs slowly. There was nothing on the first floor, as the doctor explained, except the kitchen, the storage rooms, and a few odd chambers for servants to occupy. Above were the important apartments. He showed a dining room, a bedroom or two, with a bath across the hall. And Weldon was delighted with what he saw. Those deep, eye-like casements were even narrower from the inside than from the outside, for they were built funnel-shaped, though rectangular, of course. They gave an air of the most solid security to each room.
"Ah," Weldon said presently, "of course the General was a veteran of the Indian days, and that's why these windows are really simply enlarged shot holes." "Exactly," the doctor smiled again. "And the house is, as you see, built like a fort."
He pointed to the thickness of the walls. The side wall was at least 4 feet through.
"You like it?"
he asked Weldon eagerly.
"Of course I like it. There's no dog about this."
"No, no pretense at all. The General was an honest man. You see the furniture. He could have had costly things carried here, but he preferred something more in keeping with the country. He had a sense of harmony. He never would have a piano brought here for his wife or his daughter. 'Go riding outdoors,' he would say. 'There's music enough when the wind gets into the pines.' He had a rough, determined way of speaking. He never was in doubt."
"Of course he wasn't," murmured Weldon. He was beginning to see the old General very clearly. "Was he feeble in his last days?" he asked.
"Ah, no, not a whit. He could jump into the saddle almost like a boy. And 3 days before he died, I saw him take one of those ponderous old Kentucky rifles and with it shoot a squirrel out of the top of a pine tree. No, no, his body was sound enough."
At this inference of other and more terrible troubles than mere afflictions of the body, Weldon turned and glanced sharply at his companion, because it was a theme that readily could be expanded. But there was no enlargement of the thought. Dr. Watts had gone on to the door and opened it. He closed it again and turned back, resting his shoulders against the door. His eyes were almost closed. There was pain in his lowered eyes.
"I am about to take you to see Helen O'Malley," he said.
He sighed, and then went on.
"As for her condition, I won't say that she is doomed, Mr. Weldon."
"I hope not," Weldon said in a grave voice.
"But I want you to understand that, for my part, I put her off the theory that what troubles her really is consumption. Even when her eyes are sunken, and when there is fever in her cheeks, I try to make light of everything. I speak a little about persistent colds and a little about fevers."
Just then, from the distance, Weldon heard a faint, harsh cough. a dry, barking sound rapidly repeated. He took a long breath.
"Very well," he said. "I'm to be cheerful. Is that it?"
"You understand exactly, my dear friend. I want you just to be a little warned beforehand. She's a delicate creature. Her mother never was very strong. Helen, we thought, would be quite robust, but she seemed to melt. She seemed to melt."
Weldon hastily averted his eyes. His heart was very full for this stricken old man who, it was apparent, was pouring out his love upon this invalid girl. Then he passed on before his guide. Chapter 11. The doctor opened the door again. They passed into a large bedroom, the bed itself in the corner to the right, a large four-poster with a heavy canopy over it, so that it looked like an echo of a dead century. It was altogether one of the strangest chambers that Weldon ever had seen. On the floor were the skins of a grizzly and a mountain lion. On the walls hung masks of beasts of prey, and intermixed among these were strange weapons of war, African spears with blades like leaves, razor-sharp at the edge, and long, slender bows, and delicate and deadly arrows. There were Malay knives, with their terrible wavy edges. There were deeply curved Arabian scimitars, and yonder a pair of long, ancient muskets, their barrels richly arabesqued.
"This is the room of the general?" Weldon murmured.
"Yes, you are right. This is his room. Helen won't have anything changed, though he's been dead more than a year."
"He hunted in all those places?" Weldon said, indicating a great rhinoceros horn on the one hand and the grim mask of a tiger on the other.
"He was all over the world. He was a restless fellow before death made him quiet at last," said the doctor.
Suddenly a shudder passed through him, as though the memory of the old man had leaped up before his eyes and was not altogether comforting. He went on to the next door.
"This is the room,"
he whispered, and his eyes softened as he spoke. He drew the door open, and as it came ajar, he announced,
"I have Mr. Weldon here, Helen. Shall I bring him in?"
A quiet voice answered. Weldon could not hear the words. The door was drawn wide, and he went in before the doctor. She lay in an invalid's chair near the window. The sun fell strongly across the shawl that was wrapped around her feet. The dazzling brightness of that sun kept the rest of her in shadow. But when Weldon came closer to meet her outstretched hand, he saw a pale face with shadows of weakness beneath the eyes. Hopelessly beautiful, he thought her, more beautiful than any woman he had seen in the wide course of his wanderings, except that girl of the day before, Francesca LaGuardia. He reflected that the old saying has it, that it never rains but always must pour. So he had found them almost together, dark-haired Francesca, golden-haired Helen. How different, too! The LaGuardia like a flaming light, and Helen O'Malley something crystal through which light may shine, something pure and clear. She reminded him of something or of someone, but he told himself that it was because she lay there so weak, so ill. A cold hand touched his own. He looked down into mild eyes, without resistance, without a challenge in them. "The great tragedy was upon her," said Weldon to himself, "and by the death to which she was drawn, she was made to resemble all who had died beautiful and died young." He stepped back a little and stood where she could see him easily. He clasped his hands behind his back. It was as pleasant to look on her as it was to listen to music. But he would not regard her too fixedly.
"Dear Dr. Henry," said the girl,
You've talked to Mr. Weldon?
Not like the bursting joy and the ring of the voice of the LaGuardia. It was